And hello, Sun Sal's listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to finish the novel that I've been reading now for about 5 months, titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. And I'm going to begin a brand new novel. So today is very special. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled This Sunday, My Daddy Came to Church. And then it's Who's the Smartest? Papa Put a Man on the Moon. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Bon Voyage, Mr. Rodriguez. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled, This Sunday, My Daddy Came to Church. My daddy doesn't go to church with me and mommy on Sunday mornings. Even when the sun is shining bright in the sky and the birds are singing a sweet Sunday song. Some Sundays are meant for doing much of nothing, or a little bit of something, my daddy says. He leans back in his recliner with a newspaper after we eat breakfast. Sometimes Daddy says, the lawn needs mowing this Sunday morning, or the game is coming on, whether it's baseball, basketball, football, tennis, or golf. Mommy smiles whenever my daddy gives a reason for not coming to church with us. She bends down and wraps her arms around him and says, I understand, Mitchell. I sure enjoy my do much of nothing or a little bit of something days, too, after a long week of work. But if you change your mind, your blue suit is in the closet. My daddy smiles and nods. Before we leave for church, he peers over his newspaper and says what he always says when I'm dressed in my Sunday best. Wow, looking dapper there, son. Yep, I sure do look dapper, Daddy, I always say, sticking my chest out. We all laugh. On our way to church, we see our neighbors going to their churches too. Miss Shelby and her son, Jabari, who towers over us all like he towers over everyone on the basketball court. They live across the street. We see Mr. Reynolds, an elder in our neighborhood. Mommy says we all must watch out for him. She always sends him a basket of goodies whenever my daddy goes to mow his lawn or fix whatever may need fixing at his house. We also see our new neighbors, Mr. Ling and his daughter Angela, and her Nai-Nai, her grandmother. And we see Mr. and Mrs. Joseph, and Imani, who's my best friend and in my tap dance class. We always walk together to church. Imani and I always skip ahead of the others. No need to take a bus or taxi or drive our car. Our church, our own 2 feet, will take us to Ebenezer Church just fine. It takes 10 minutes if we're moseying along like a turtle, and 5 minutes if we're walking like Mommy says, as if we have someplace important to go. 2 peas in a pod, Mr. Joseph always calls us. Imani and I make believe that the gray pavement is the polished floor in Miss Josephine's tap class, and that we have our noisy tap shoes instead of our Sunday church shoes. We tap all the way to the end of the street until we get to Ebenezer Church. Imani and I can't sit together anymore. The last time we did, Mommy kept saying, shush. Now, Imani sits in the row behind me. After the choir sings, I look around to see if I see my daddy. When Mommy sees me, she reaches into her purse and hands me a peppermint candy. Only one, because she says too much sugar will spoil my appetite for lunch. I lean back into the hardness of the wooden pew. I sigh like I do every Sunday, wishing my daddy would come to church too. I turn my head and make a funny face at Imani. She waves back and I start laughing. Mommy puts her finger to her lips and says, "Shh." When I bow our heads in prayer, I pray for my daddy to be there when I open my eyes. But he isn't there. I slump into my seat. When we get back home, jazz is playing softly on the radio. Daddy is standing by the stove, stirring something delicious that's simmering in a pot. "Want a taste, Omar?" he asks, offering me a spoonful after blowing on it. "Mmm, good," I say. Mommy smiles at the plate holding our lunch sandwiches. There are turkey sandwiches for her and Daddy, and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich he made for me. And there's a cold pitcher of lemonade. "Chicken and dumplings and peach cobbler for dinner," Daddy says. He slides over to Mommy, taking her hand to dance with him. They glide across the floor to the music. Then Mommy kicks off her church shoes and grabs her sandwich to go sit outside on our porch. After I change my clothes, I sit down at the kitchen table and watch my daddy finish cooking. After stirring the pot one more time, he sits down to eat his turkey sandwich as I bite into my peanut butter sandwich. Before I take another bite, I ask, "Daddy, how come you don't come to church with me and Mommy?" "Well, today I was tired, son. Maybe next Sunday," he says. Later, when we sit down to dinner, my daddy says grace as we hold hands. I peek at him with one eye open. He sees me and winks. The next week goes by lightning fast. School is Monday through Friday. Tap dance class is on Saturday with Imani. When Sunday morning comes, I am tired. I want to have a do-nothing or a little bit of something day. When it is time to leave, Mommy says, "Mitchell, we'd love to see you come at church today. And your blue suit is in the closet if you decide to come." My daddy smiles and nods his head before saying his usual, "Looking dapper there, son," as he peers over his newspaper. I don't stick out my chest this time. I wish he were walking to church with us, looking just as dapper in his blue suit. I wish he'd be sitting in our pew, his deep voice singing along with the choir and his feet tapping like when he listens to the radio at home. At church, after we settle in our seats, I think my daddy might surprise us. I glance around for him as the choir sings. We bow our heads in prayer, and I hope he'll be there when I look up, but he isn't. I sink in the wooden pew until church is over. Imani and her parents don't walk home with us this afternoon, so I walk as slowly as a turtle. "What's wrong, Omar?" Mommy asks. "Why do you always tell Daddy his blue suit is in the closet for church? He never comes," I say. "Well, when I was a little girl, my grandmother used to tell me to start picturing what you want to happen. She called it having faith, faith as small as a mustard seed. I hold on to that mustard seed of faith of your father putting on that blue suit and joining us. But even if your daddy doesn't come to church, he is still a man of faith. I love going to church, and so do you, but sometimes worship isn't in a building. Omar, It's in your heart and how you serve others. It can be when your father is helping Mr. Reynolds, or when he goes to the shelter to serve food, or even when he's sitting on our porch, she says with a smile. That makes me feel better. I start tapping across the pavement, and this time, Mommy joins me. The next week, when Sunday morning comes, I get ready for church. Looking dapper there as usual, son, my daddy says, as he peers over his newspaper. I tiptoe into my parents' bedroom and go to Daddy's dresser, top drawer. I pick out his blue striped tie and lay it across the bed. What are you doing? Mommy asks when she comes into the room to get her Bible. Oh, just picturing things, I say with a grin. My mommy's laugh fills the room like her perfume, and she kisses me on the forehead. Then we go to say goodbye to my daddy. I picked out your blue striped tie for you to wear with your blue suit, Daddy, just in case you decide to come to church, I say. My daddy looks surprised. He smiles and nods. At church, after the choir sings, I turn to Imani and wave at her. She makes a funny face. I make a funny face back. We both start giggling. Shh! I hear a deep voice behind me say, "It's my daddy!" He has a wide smile across his face. He has on his blue suit and the blue striped tie I picked out for him. "You look dapper there, Daddy," I say, sticking out my chest. I sit up in my seat, sandwiched between the love of my mommy and daddy. It feels as beautiful as the sunbeams streaming through the stained glass windows, creating a rainbow around us, our neighbors, and all the other worshipers. This Sunday, my daddy came to church. And even if he doesn't come next Sunday, I know he worships in his own special way. Who's the smartest? It's just an ordinary day. Olive is outside in the yard, sniffing for animal tracks. She loves to follow her nose and dig holes to find little critters. But it's hard work, and it has made her very hungry. Just like on any other day after digging, Olive runs inside looking for tasty kibbles. And just like on any other day, she lies down in her doggy bed to take a nap. After her nap, Olive likes to read in her book about squirrels. She often sees squirrels in her yard. Olive leaves the big gray one alone. He's as big as she is, but she loves to chase after the red one. He's small and fast, faster than Olive. She's reading her book when, wait a minute, what kind of sound is that? Olive listens closely. Is that squirrel? Faster than the wind, Olive runs outside where she sees squirrel. She chases him around the tree a few times. Yee-haw! But suddenly, Squirrel stops running. He turns to Olive. Stop, he says. That's enough. If you keep running after me like this, I'll have no time to gather enough acorns before winter, and then I'll have nothing to eat. You have to stop chasing me. I can't play with you anymore. Disappointed, Olive walks back inside. Squirrel has no time to play in the spring, she grumbles, and no time to play in the fall. He has no time to play ever. This can't go on. I need to come up with a plan so Squirrel will have time to play again. It starts raining. Ugh, everything is wet. And Squirrel won't play anyway, sighs Olive. She drags a big bone into her cozy bed. She curls up in a tight ball, ready to go back to sleep. Suddenly, she hears another loud cry. "What's that?" she wonders. Olive quickly runs outside, where she sees Squirrel running lightning fast to a tree. "I thought he didn't have time to play," thinks Olive. "Why can't I join in?" Angrily, she goes back inside. Squeak, squeak, squeak! But Squirrel continues to make a racket. Olive has never heard him scream so loudly. There must be something wrong. She looks up. There's Squirrel, high up in the tree. And under the tree stands Fox. "Howdy, Fox," says Olive. "What are you doing? Don't you know that Squirrel is too busy to play?" Fox looks puzzled at the tiny dog. "Play?" he says. "I'm hungry, and Squirrel is a delicious snack." "Oh, no," frets Olive. "Fox wants to eat Squirrel. I have to help my little friend." She knows all too well how cunning foxes can be. So she has to find a clever way to rescue Squirrel. "Come play with me," says Olive to the fox. "I know a place where there's plenty of food." Fox looks at Olive with distrust. "Yeah, what does this little dog want?" he wonders. "To lure me away and then steal my dinner?" But Olive is very persuasive and sweet talks the fox into coming with her. Hesitantly, the hungry fox follows Olive, who's already running toward the house. "Uh-oh," thinks Olive. "What can I offer Fox?" Then she remembers the food she hid some time ago. She starts digging, and Fox joins in. Soon, they find some bones, and Fox happily starts chewing. Olive not only finds her bone collection, but a tennis ball as well. When Fox is done eating and satisfied, he rubs his belly. Olive rolls the ball to him. Fox likes to play with the ball too. Together, they run after it. Squirrel looks at the two in amazement. Then he gets an idea. He throws an acorn from the tree. It rolls down the hill, and Olive runs right after it. Olive always runs after everything. Squirrel knows that very well. And if they leave him alone, he can continue looking for acorns. But Olive also has a plan. "Let's find more acorns to play with," she says to Fox. Olive playfully rolls acorns under the tree, and so does Fox. The mountain of acorns gets bigger and bigger. Squirrel watches, his mouth watering. "Exactly what I need for the winter," he thinks. Fox yawns, tired and very pleased with himself. He runs back into the woods. "Ha," he says, "my belly is full, and I didn't even have to work for it. I'm smart. I'm very smart." Olive is also tired and walks inside the house to take a nap. Squirrel keeps hauling his acorns into the tree. He smiles. "I've tricked both Olive and Fox because I distracted them. I was able to keep gathering acorns. It turned out even better than I thought. Now I have a huge supply for the winter. Tomorrow I can relax and play all day." Curled up in her favorite chair, Olive also thinks about the day full of adventure. "Fox thinks he's smart, I'm sure, because he figured out how to get a free meal. Squirrel probably thinks he's smart too, because he got me to chase after the acorn he threw from the tree. Squirrel knows I like to chase things. So Fox and Squirrel are both smart. But I save Squirrel by luring Fox away from the tree and giving him something to eat. I also tricked Fox into collecting acorns. my plan to build up a supply of food for Squirrel so that he has free time worked. Now Squirrel can play with me every day. It's very clear to me I'm the smartest of all. Papa put a man on the moon. The full moon rises high over our hill like a lantern shining at sea. Papa and I sit side by side, waiting until that bright halo arcs high over our heads. When Papa points, I squint to find the Sea of Tranquility, where the newsman, Mr. Cronkite, said men will one day stand on the surface of the moon. I stretch my hand out straight as I can, but the moon's too far away to imagine an ordinary man reaching out to touch its face, just as easy as I touch my Papa's. 3 days ago, Mama whispered to me Papa's job at the mill changed, and now he's doing important government work. The fabric he weaves is one layer in the spacesuit our astronauts wear. I ask him, Papa, aren't you proud? You work for the president. Papa closes his eyes and leans back on the steps.
Only proud to make a living, Martha Ann. Only proud to make a living.
But I know better. We hear it on the news each night and in chatter at the supermarket each Saturday. Our little mill village is one piece of something big, bigger than we ever dared to think we could be. I can't help but let that make me feel proud. When it's time for bed, Papa takes my toothbrush and bobbles it just out of reach, pretending it's twirling through zero gravity, like we saw the Apollo astronauts do on TV. To the moon, I cry, as he snatches me up, floating me to bed with twists and turns. I fall asleep dreaming I am drifting through stars. That spring, I walk with Papa from the mill each night, my heart heavy as blossoms on dogwood trees. Do you think we'll make it to the moon, Papa?
Well, nothing to do but watch and see, he says.
But time passes slowly, and my hope unravels like a string. I wish we'd hurry. Finally, one day, come summer, three astronauts blast off, and this time Mr. Cronkite says they're going for the moon. Watching the news, I can practically feel the rumble of the engines and the rush of air from the explosions that push that rocket into the heavens. 4 days later, they're all set. When Papa turns the TV on, I leave my usual spot on the floor and nestle onto the couch beside him. Papa squishes closer to Mama, and together we listen as the lunar module descends toward the moon. When Walter Cronkite takes off his glasses, repeating, "Oh boy, oh boy," my heart starts beating that same rhythm.
The Eagle has landed.
Later, I hold my breath as Neil Armstrong steps from the ladder and lands where no man has stood, not ever before.
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Papa doesn't say a word, and I don't break his quiet with what I'm thinking, but I know it's true anyway. Somewhere in that spacesuit, in the thick layers protecting Mr. Armstrong, are threads my Papa touched, threads he wove together into sheets of fabric, the same fabric keeping those astronauts alive in outer space. Those threads go from Papa, a man whose feet have hardly left our hill, to our astronauts, now leaving their footprints in moon dust. Papa says he's just making a living. But I know better. No need to shout it loud. It's right there on TV for the world to see. My papa put a man on the moon. And here's the author's note. In 1962, in an effort to rally the nation around the Apollo space program, President John F. Kennedy declared, "We choose to go to the moon in this decade." The federal government invested billions of dollars and hired factories across the United States to build each piece of equipment needed to make this bold mission a reality. One of those factories was a J.P. Stevens textile mill in Slater, South Carolina, where my own grandparents, parents, aunts, and uncles all worked at one time or another. In the 1960s, this mill began producing beta cloth, a fiberglass thread fabric pioneered by Dr. Frederick Dawn, a NASA textile expert. This fabric would become one of the layers in the Apollo spacesuits. At the time, the mill workers who made this fabric felt they were simply doing their jobs, making an honest living in textiles. But when the mission was finally accomplished and Neil Armstrong stepped onto the surface of the moon, they knew they had contributed to a monumental American achievement. I wrote this book to honor the men, women, and communities across the United States that made the moon landing possible through their work ethic and dedication. I'd like to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled Bon Voyage, Mr. Rodriguez. Every afternoon at 4 o'clock, Mr. Rodriguez stepped out of a narrow laneway and strolled through the street. To us, it looked as if he had clouds under his coat, or maybe balloons. Every day we would hide behind the trunk of an oak tree and wait for the old man to pass by. One Monday, at exactly 4 o'clock, Mr. Rodriguez stepped into the street and stopped. He'd looked left and right. Then he looked down, as if to check the position of his feet. We held our breath. Was he waiting for someone? Although we could not say why, we knew that today would be different. A dove fluttered down and settled on the tip of his shoe. Very gently, Mr. Rodriguez attached a fine silk thread around her foot, and off they went. On Tuesday, Mr. Rodriguez floated down the street with a fishbowl carefully balanced on his head. On Wednesday, an old sheepdog slowly approached him. Mr. Rodriguez settled the weary dog into a sled, and together they slipped down the street. We wondered what would happen on Thursday. None of the adults seemed to notice Mr. Rodriguez coming or going. On Thursday, a cat slowly limped up to Mr. Rodriguez. He tied a pair of wings to the old kitty's back. On Friday, a piano appeared on the street. Mr. Rodriguez sat down, and a fine melody floated out to sea. On Saturday, Mr. Rodriguez did not show up at all. This had never happened before. We searched and searched, but we could not find him. Perhaps Mr. Rodriguez had changed his routine? On Sunday, we arrived early in the morning to wait for him. Suddenly, he appeared out of nowhere, far above us. He was not alone. And there he is. He's up in the air, floating over the ocean. He has the goldfish, and he has the cat with wings, and he's sitting on the piano, and the dog in the sled. He winked and pointed to the clouds in the distance. We never saw Mr. Rodriguez after that. He had gone away probably forever, but we knew he was happy. So we left a message in the sand. Bon voyage, Mr. R. And the last picture shows him up in the air, and he's playing the piano. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to finish the novel that I've been reading now for about 5 months, titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. Jack Henry, the hero of Heads or Tails, Stories from the Sixth Grade, is back. It is the summer after sixth grade, and Jack and his offbeat family have relocated to the island of Barbados. Jack hopes he's escaping the craziness of his old life in Florida, but even in a Caribbean paradise, he is plagued by misadventure. He gets a violent case of blood poisoning and ends up painted purple from head to toe, discovers the perils of male bonding in a pepper-eating contest with his father, and has his heartstrings twanged by an older woman, his sister's best friend, to name just a few of his troubles. But in these eight fierce and funny stories, Jack always perseveres, sometimes with the help of one of the few reliable things in his life, his trusty diary. Okay, last week, in the final story titled Fire, Jack found out that his family owes a lot of money, and now they might have to move from Barbados. His parents just had a huge argument, and his dad put his fist through the glass door. And that's where I left off last week. In the morning, Pete and I woke up acting like members of a retreating army. I opened one of my hollowed-out diaries and removed two packages of firecrackers. For once, I agreed with Mom's favorite line, "If you don't use it, throw it away." Only I added a twist to her thinking, "If you don't use it, blow it up." "Gather the stuff you don't want anymore," I ordered. "We don't want to leave anything behind." Pete went into his room and returned with his plastic sailboat with ripped sails. "Blow it up," he said. "I don't want it anymore." We took it out to the backyard. I taped a firecracker to the main mast. Pete lit it, and we stepped away. Boom! The mast split in half. "Excellent," he cried gleefully. We blew off the rest of the mast and then the rudder and keel. After that, we tossed it into the trash. No one would ever play with that again. I brought out a lamp made of a carved coconut. A few minutes later, it was destroyed. Pete brought his old shoes, and we blew the soles off. I blew up a math book. Pete blew up a mobile of painted fish, which had been made out of mango seeds. With each blast, we jumped up and down and cheered. When we were down to our last six firecrackers, I said, "I know what I want to blow up." Dad had painted our name, Henry, on a wooden plaque and wired it onto the front gate. I wrapped the remaining firecrackers into one big bomb and taped it to the plaque. "Fire in the hole," I hollered and lit the fuses. I had twisted together. It went off like a truck backfire and echoed between the houses. The plaque blew in half. One piece stayed on the gate. The other landed in the street. Pete put two fingers in his mouth and let out a long whistle. "That is so cool," he said. "I wish we had some dynamite." Just then, a black panel van pulled up. The driver leaned out the window. "You guys know where the Henrys live?" "Right here," I replied. "Why?" "Are you here to move us out?" "Well, just the animals," he said, looking at a clipboard. "I'm from the Humane Society. Your mother called and said to come get the dog and cat. We'll find them new homes." The Henry family retreat was underway. The enemy advance scouts were already on our doorstep.
I reconnoitered the driveway. Bobo, too, was asleep in front of the garage. Celeste was sitting on the kitchen stairs, licking her paws. I raised my head and looked up into the smoky sky. Oh, God, I thought, I don't want to see this. But here it was. The driver had also seen Bobo, too, and Celeste. He quickly got a butterfly net and two wire cages out of the van. Call the dog over, he said as nicely as he could, and put on a pair of heavy leather gloves. Can't do it, I replied. He turned toward Pete. Me either, Pete said. Not even if you torture me. The man shrugged and walked up the driveway. He went directly to Bobo 2, grabbed his collar, then trotted him back to the cage. Bobo 2 went right in, and after circling around a few times, sat down and stared out at us. Tomorrow, he'd be sleeping 23 hours a day at someone else's house and never know the difference. There is an advantage to having such a tiny brain, I thought. There is no room to remember your past. He picked up the cage and slid it into the back of the van. So long, fella, I said. Pete began to cry. Hey, I said, better him than you. He turned and punched me in the chest. Before I could punch him back, Celeste let out a screech. The guy had her half into the butterfly net. He was reaching for her with his leather glove when she broke away. She honked him good across, hooked him good across the nose, then leapt into the driveway and across into the Grotham's bushes. Go, 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 I shouted and waved my fist over my head. I could see her working through the thick leaves and stems, and then she was gone. Celeste was smart. She knew not to hang around us. I hoped she would run up into the hill and eat mice and live free. I wanted to run away and live with her, but the island was too small. Someone would find me, and just like Bobo too, I'd be sent home in a cage to face the music. It would be better if I had caught her, the man said when he returned to the truck. Between the wild dogs and mongoose, she'll be killed. Oh, she's tougher than that, I said defiantly. Well, tell your mother I tried, he said, and wiped a spot of blood off his nose. He put away the empty cage, then climbed into the truck and drove off. That afternoon, Mom came home with a set of new suitcases. Pack your good clothes and play clothes, she said, meaning business. We're leaving today. Your father will ship the rest up to us. Where are we going? I asked. Miami, she replied. We're leaving in 4 hours. Now get a move on. We each took a suitcase and dragged it to our room. I slipped my story diaries into my backpack. I could carry them onto the plane with me. They were the most important thing I owned. Once we were in Miami, I could open them and read about where I had been. Then I would get new diaries and write about where I was going. I only packed the clothes I still liked. When I finished, I dragged the suitcases out to the front porch and went to find Pete. He was with Betsy. She was packing up for boarding school. The baby was asleep in his crib. I half expected him to be packing up his little outfits. Betsy gave Pete a hug, then me. Write me long letters, she said. I'll write back. What about Mom and Dad? I asked. Well, Dad's going to stay until he settles the bills. Then he'll join you in Miami. Mom just wants to get a head start and get you boys in a new school. I couldn't even think of a new school. Just the thought of meeting new people wore me out. I drifted down to my bedroom to rest. For the next 2 hours, I just sat on my bed, thinking of things I should do. I should write Mr. Cucumber a thank you note. He was tough, but smart and fair. I should go say so long to the names and Shiva and the Hunts. But I didn't. I just felt empty, used up. Every time I thought of saying goodbye, I expected they'd ask why, and I'd just throw up my hands and shrug.
adults, I'd reply. I just do as I'm told and hope for the best. Dad arrived and loaded the station wagon. He and Mom didn't speak. They seemed to communicate in grunts. Marlene had swept up the glass, but their feelings for each other were still smashed up. But they'd make up soon. They always did. Pete and I took our seats. I was numb until I looked at Betsy. She was crying. I waved, then sucked in my gut and held my breath until we were out of the driveway and around the corner. At the airport, Mom, Pete, and I stood on the terminal balcony and waited for the jet to land. We watched it circle overhead, then turn toward the runway. But it dropped down too fast and hit the runway with a thud. The tires blew, and the jet screeched up the runway, leaving two long black trails of smoked rubber. The ground shook as the jet slowly shuddered to a stop. Suddenly, the hot tires burst into flames. The fire crews hustled onto the tarmac. They sprayed a swoopy circle of white foam, like whipped cream, over the tires and put out the fire. It looked as though the jet had landed on top of a birthday cake. Above the fire crew, the jet doors swung open and orange plastic slides unfolded like enormous walking caterpillars. One by one, the passengers slid to safety and ran through the foam toward the terminal. "This is an omen," Mom murmured, shaking her head from side to side. "What does it mean?" I asked. "We shouldn't leave," she replied. Just then, Gunny rushed up to her. "We're throwing a Betty can't leave party at our house," she gushed. "Come on." Mom looked hesitant. "It'll be fun," Gunny said, and reached for Mom's straw carry bag. "You could use a lift." "Okay," Mom replied. "It doesn't look as if we're leaving." "Yes, we're staying. Mom and Dad will make up, and Dad's business will improve, and Betsy will stay with us. And if we hurry, we can get Bobo too back. And I can get the Henry plaque back on the gate." We rushed across the terminal and back to the parking lot. We hopped into the station wagon, and suddenly everything was different. Dad wasn't scaring us. Everyone was happy at the same time. "This is what's important," I thought to myself. "Not where we live, but how we live. If we stuck together, I wouldn't care if we lived in a shack, wore rags, and ate lima beans out of a can." Gunny and her husband, Tim, grilled hot dogs and fish. They had a case of lemon squash, and I ate and drank until I couldn't stay awake. I looked around the room. Mom and Dad were sitting together and laughing. Everyone was having fun. Things were returning to normal. I slipped into the spare bedroom. Pete was already asleep. I lay next to him and conked out. In the middle of the night, I was awakened. "Let's go," Mom whispered. "They're waiting for us at the airport." I was confused. "Huh?" I said sleepily. "What?" She lifted me up by my arms and swung my legs over the edge of the mattress. "I have to get the baby," she said. "You wake Pete and get him ready." "What happened?" I asked. "Well, they brought in new tires from Puerto Rico, and the plane is ready," she replied. "Now hurry." "I thought we were staying," I asked. "That was just party talk," she said. "Wishful thinking." I wished it were true. "Where's Dad?" "Asleep," she said. "Tim's driving us." "Why?" I asked. "Dad always did all the dad stuff." "He needs his sleep," she said impatiently. "He'll join us later. Now get going." I helped Pete stagger out to the car. In a few minutes, we were at the airport. The airline crew was waiting for us. We climbed up the stairs and entered the jet. As soon as we took our seats, they closed the door and we taxied down the runway, turned, and took off. Once we were up in the air, I looked out the window. The sugarcane fires were still glowing. As we traveled farther away, I thought Barbados would look frightening, as if We had just escaped a burning ship. But I was wrong. The fires stretched from coast to coast like party lights strung across the deck of a beautiful luxury liner. It wasn't the island that was sinking. It was us. The plane banked to the west. I looked out the window. The island was gone. And that's the end of Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, I'm going to begin a brand new novel. And it is titled Too Bright to See. It also happens to be a Newbery Honor Book, a Stonewall Book Award, and the National Book Award finalist. Too Bright to See. 11-year-old Bug is used to haunted things. After all, the occasional cold spot or mysteriously slamming door is to be expected when your house is almost as old as the dirt it sits on. But when a new presence makes itself known the summer before Bug starts middle school, it's clear that this spirit is intent on communicating something directly to Bug. But what and why? As Bug begins to untangle the mystery of this new ghost, an altogether different truth tugs free. It's the answer to a question of identity. One Bug never even thought to ask. And here's the prologue. It's strange living in our old house now that Uncle Roderick is dead. I already knew my house is haunted. It's always been haunted. That hasn't changed. We avoid the freezing cold spot in the center of the living room because someone probably died there. Windows slam themselves open or shut on the stillest days. So do doors, and these doors are heavy. For a long time, I thought it was normal to sense someone standing behind you or next to you and not be able to see them. For invisible hands to brush past your hair, your clothes. And it looks haunted, wooden, unpainted, weathered with time. There's an elaborately carved front door. Peaked roofs jutted out in all directions, tall windows with shapes flickering behind them. The porch wraps around front to back with rocking chairs that sometimes rock on their own. We're out in the middle of nowhere, and at nighttime, there's moonlight and starlight and nothing else. When I was in kindergarten, I checked a book out of the library because the house on the front cover looked like a photograph of my home. Uncle Roderick tried reading it to me that night, my head resting on his chest, his arm tucked beneath my shoulders. We always read together before bed. He had to stop after the first chapter because it was a collection of scary stories. He believed that dreams were important and he didn't want to give me bad ones. But now, this old house seems haunted in a different way, a way that's both more boring and more frightening. There's a half-empty jar of okra Uncle Roderick picked and picked that he never finished eating. And Mom and I both hate okra. His winter boots are jammed in the closet. He always put off wearing them for as long as possible, saying they made him look like a lumberjack, but now he'll never need them again. He subscribed to magazines, the New Yorker, National Geographic, and they'll keep being addressed to him until we tell them to stop, until they take his name off the list forever. I prefer the ghost. Chapter 1. The moment he dies. I know. It's the middle of the night. My eyes open, and I grip the mattress with both hands. I'm suddenly irrationally convinced that my bed is toppling over, like it's unbalanced, perched precariously on the top of a mountain and about to come crashing down, or like it's teetering on the edge of a black hole, with nothing familiar on the other side. Uncle Roderick's room is at the top of the stairs. Mom's is at the end of the hall. For 11 years, I've fallen asleep snug in the middle, their warmth and weight keeping me grounded from both sides. Even these past couple months, when he's been in the hospital and then the hospice, I could still feel him there, keeping me safe at the top of the stairs. But now I know my uncle is gone. The stairs creak sharp and loud. That doesn't mean anything. They creak all the time. The house is settling, is what Mom says, and sometimes it might be a harmless ghost. But now I hear the groan of a foot on a step, and then another. It's like the sound of someone slowly moving up our wide staircase, someone with a heavy tread. It's mid-June and hot, and I'm lying under a sheet with a fan blowing warm air around the room. I pull the sheet up to my chin, wishing for the weight of a comforter to press me into the mattress, something to hide under. The creaks stop at the top, right in front of Uncle Roderick's bedroom door. I hold my breath and strain my ears. I can't hear anything, but it doesn't sound like no one's there. It sounds like someone being silent. I only exhale when the creaks descend the stairs as slowly as they came. Uncle Roderick always told me that passing spirits and lingering presences are a normal part of living in a house almost as old as the dirt it sits on. Mom says that the creepy things I sense or feel or hear are just part of an active imagination, and that Uncle Roderick shouldn't encourage it, that ghosts aren't real. I only occasionally believe my mom when the sun is bright and I can explain away strange hands touching my neck or a mysteriously slammed shut door as stray gusts of wind in a drafty old building. I believe my uncle now, surely and suddenly, but I don't want to. There's no one on the stairs, I tell myself, wanting it to be true, still holding on to the mattress for dear life. There's no one on the stairs. There's no one on the stairs. There's no one on the stairs. The rhythm pounds through my brain, repeating itself over and over, crowding out every other thought that also must be true. I manage to fall asleep by curling up into a ball, my back turned toward the half of the room that echoes the new emptiness in my chest. I wake up again a few hours later because the phone rings. I feel grounded now, not in a free fall, not hurtling through space, but there's an empty room inside my chest. Mom's voice struggles through the wall. None of the words are clear, but if I didn't know about Uncle Roderick already, I would know now from her tone, the rise and fall of sentences. She comes into my bedroom a few minutes later, and I sit up. She holds me and cries. I've seen my mother cry before, but it's never been my job to comfort her. It's always been Uncle Roderick's job. But her brother's not here, and I am. I hold her tight and breathe as slowly as possible until her sobs subside. I should have cried that first day, almost a year ago, when Uncle Roderick came home from the doctor with bad news, but I couldn't. I remember a rushing sound filling my ears, drowning out the details, my brain refusing to take in anything beyond one main truth. Something too big to touch, with no details to snag on. I told myself I'd only cry once he was gone. But that day has come, and I've got nothing, no tears, and no anything else. There's sadness, but it's whirling around outside of me, like a hurricane of grief, and I'm the dry, unmoving eye. He loved you very much, you know, Mom says. After a bit, she lets go, sits up straight, palms the tears off her cheeks. I wish I had a tissue to offer her. I know he did, I say. And I do. but it doesn't help. Mom hugs me once more, then says she has to make some phone calls. I stare across my room, sunlight streaming through the tall window with rippled glass, and wonder what happens after this. Chapter 2. Mom and Uncle Roderick and I rattled around our house like peas in an oversized pod. Sometimes we would have house guests from New York City or Burlington or Montreal, filling it up with noise and laughter and memories. But the three of us could fill it up just as well. Tonight the house is full of people and memories, but not much laughter. Family friends have come from all over, but not many people from our little pocket of Vermont show up. We moved here when I was a baby, and old Vermonters don't acknowledge you until there's six in the ground. Six dead people, they mean, in a row, stretching back through the years. Well, we've got our first. But Uncle Roderick isn't even in the ground, not really. He didn't want a funeral, he said, or a burial. Just sprinkle my ashes on the land, he told us toward the end. We did, putting handfuls in the creek, the woods, the garden, everywhere. Mom says that everyone deserves a chance to say goodbye. I wish they could say goodbye somewhere else. The house has never been this full before, and I can't go hide with Uncle Roderick in his room. I have to wear this dress that makes me look like Samantha from the American Girl books. It's rumpled from being at the bottom of my closet for months, and Uncle Roderick usually took care of the ironing. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, Too Bright to See. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.